Now let's turn our attention to another classic in the NLP repertoire. This is called the visual squash. Now the history of the visual squash is actually very hypnotic. In fact, this technique was something that Richard Bandler and John Grinder actually witnessed Milton Erickson doing and decided to copy and put into the NLP syllabus. For those of you who are trained hypnotherapists, you'll know this technique by another name, which is also known as a parts integration. The key distinction about the visual squash is actually something which has nothing to do with the visual squash. It's to do with the way you set it up, and it's actually a very important segment on what you do. Before we launch into the technique itself, I'd like to talk a little bit about the purpose of the visual squash, especially when you compare it to other techniques. The primary reason for a visual squash is to deal with a situation where people have some kind of internal conflict. They want to do A, but they want to do B as well. And A and B somehow conflict. Perhaps it's some kind of self-sabotage. You know, they want to stop smoking, but every time they try, something makes them do it anyway. Or they want to go to the gym, but every time they start going, something saps their willpower, saps their energy, saps their will to live, and they stop doing it. So there's clearly some kind of internal conflict going on, shall we say, between two parts, a part that wants A and a part that wants B, where A and B are mutually exclusive. Should I leave my job or should I stay where I am? Should I stop smoking, but really I don't know if I can? These are the kind of situations that visual squash is designed for, because what it basically does is it takes these two parts, finds a way of reintegrating them, first with each other, and then secondly with the total personality of the person. So instead of having a conflict where you have towards away from, this is, I want this, but kind of this is away, you also have something called a towards conflict, which is two things. Both of them can be good. You don't quite know which one do you want to go towards. So an example might be, you know, I want to go on holiday to France, but I want to go to holiday Spain as well. Where should I go to? So these are the kind of conflicts that the visual squash will help. Both towards conflicts, in other words, two positive events and you're not sure which one will be the better, as well as towards away from conflicts. In other words, I want to do X, but somehow I keep getting sabotaged whilst trying to do so. In order to do this, we're going to go through a sequence of steps, which I'm going to describe in a moment, and then stop and examine each part of the mechanism so you understand it fully. And you'll notice that although technically this is a quote-unquote submodality technique because we're talking about the images, you could equally call this a reframing technique, because the real killer, the bit that turns the key, that makes a change, is all about using reframing in a particular way. And the starting point for this technique is very simple. You're going to start off to find or identify a conflict. You need to have two parts that are conflicting with each other that you can identify. Now, typically, you're not going to stop there and say, oh, I want you to identify two parts, let's go for it. Typically, what will happen is, as you speak to the person about their problem, you'll notice that they'll keep oscillating between two parts. Sometimes you can even hear them and see them physically shifting from one to the other. You know, I want to stop smoking, but I just feel so good, and you know, it feels like I'm de-stressing, I'm losing a friend. Or, you know, I've been offered this great job, and you know, it's at a new company. Yeah, but then, you know, I kind of like the job I'm in at the moment as well, so it's kind of taking a risk. So you want to identify these two parts, and by paying attention during your fact-finding mission at the beginning, this will kind of naturally evolve, and you should naturally be directed towards visual squash or a similar kind of technique that allows you to integrate two conflicting parts. Now, let's assume you have identified these two parts. The next thing to do is to anchor the two parts in spatially, physically. Simply put, what you're going to do is you're going to take the palms of the person's hand. You're going to turn them up so the palms are facing up towards the sky and the backs of the hands are facing down toward the ground. And one of the tricks you want to do before you even anchor the parts into the hands is, because remember we're looking for ABS, we're looking for a hypnotic context to make these things work, and in NLP the hypnotic context is going to be more indirect, it's going to be more covert. One of the things that you can do is actually set up this whole starting point to make it more hypnotic. The way I like to do this is I pick up someone's hand and start talking about a part. Let's take a simple conflict, like, I want to go to the gym, but every time I try, I fail. I stop going, I lose motivation, I just can't make myself do it anymore. Okay? So it's a simple towards away from conflict, you know, where the person wants something, but somehow some part of him is sabotaging it. So typically I might start with the positive thing. So I'll grab hold of one hand, doesn't really matter which, and I'll hold it inside my hand. Now, using something called ambiguous touch, where basically you hold the hand, but as you're talking and gesturing with one hand, or you're gesturing with the other hand, you keep switching grip from left hand to right hand to left hand again. Sometimes you hold it from the top, sometimes you support from the bottom, sometimes you hold it with one or two fingers, sometimes you hold with both hands. So you're constantly and very subtly shifting your grip on that hand. Now what will happen is, as you're speaking naturally, so you're distracting their attention from that hand, is that hand will tend to become cataleptic. Sometimes you can just hold it there and just tell them to hold it there. But typically, I like to let the hand become cataleptic as I talk to them because it tells me that something hypnotic is already going on. I have the base conditions to make this into a very powerful change technique happening almost kind of spontaneously. People don't even realize it's going on. Now, as I'm doing this whole talking and setup and I'm holding onto the hand in different ways and lightly touching it here and there and holding onto the wrist and letting go and just making my touch lighter and lighter as I go along and more ambiguous, so they're never quite sure when I'm not touching it anymore, I'm going to ask them to think about, you know, this hand and say, you know, you've got obviously this part of you that wants to go to the gym, and this part of you that prevents you from doing so. Now, sometimes these parts will naturally emerge on one side of the body and the other, which is to say that when they talk about one part, they'll probably gesture more with the left hand. When they talk about the other hand, other part, they'll gesture more with the other hand. That pretty much tells you which hand to use for which part. If they don't do something as obvious as that, then you can just ask them. Just look at your hand and just imagine one of those parts in there. Which part seems to fit best into that hand? So you basically get to do a creative visual image that represents one of those parts and to put it, say, into the left hand. Now, for argument's sake, let's say that the left hand is the part that represents wanting to go to the gym. So using ambiguous touch, you get some catalepsy. And as you're getting catalepsy, you're talking about the two parts, you know, going to the gym, not going to the gym. And one of those parts will want to emerge more naturally, will seem more right to emerge in this hand. Which hand would you like it to be? Oh, going to the gym. Okay, so form a visual representation of that hand, of that part in your hand. What does that mean? It could be a symbol. It could be like a running machine from the gym. It could be them actually doing something, like being in the gym lifting weights. It could be something totally symbolic, like an abstract design of some sort. It doesn't really matter what it is, as long as it's visual. And they can kind of imagine that symbol being in the hand. And we'll explain why we want that in a moment. So you can allow that symbol to emerge in the hand. The best thing to have is a symbol which includes them. So running machine with then maybe running on next to it or on top of it, or lifting weights or getting some instruction or feeling great or something like that. Now you're going to turn your attention to the other hand, and of course you already know which part's going to come out on that side. And you're pretty much going to do the same thing, the same kind of ambiguous touch. You're going to still look for catalepsy. You're going to still talk about that other part a little bit more as you're touching it ambiguously, which allows that hand to basically anchor in that part in that hand, and then you're going to create, finally, to cap it all off, a visual representation of that particular part. So now we have the setup. We have the left hand with the part that wants to go to the gym, we have the right hand with the part that's becoming lazy and prevents them going to the gym. Both hands are now hovering somewhere around their waist level, not touching anything, so they're cataleptic in the air. And their attention is fixated on the ideas that these parts represent rather than the fact that their hands are now cataleptic. So this is something that they won't even realize is going on. Next thing you want to do is you want to separate the intention from the behavior. Now, remember the old NLP presupposition that behavior and intention are two separate things. There's no such thing as a negative intention. Every behavior, no matter how negative it is, will ultimately be driven by some kind of positive intention. Now, the way I like to do this is to begin with the positive part. In other words, the part that wants to go to the gym. Why? Well, because we'll have a strong contrast in a minute when we go on to the negative part. So the first thing you're going to do is you're going to ask the person, what's this part after? The part that wants to get to the gym. What's it trying to achieve for you in your life? What's it trying to do for you? And typically they'll say things like, oh, it wants me to be healthy. And you might say, well, what do you want to be healthy for? What does that do for you? When you're healthy, what does it do for you? Well, when I feel healthy, I feel good. I feel relaxed, I feel empowered, I feel strong, something like that. Now, you're looking for a high-level normalization. Healthy could well be one of them, but I would tend to go a little bit higher. It depends really on how they're responding. And I might look for something like to feel empowered, to enjoy life or make the most out of life, something which is very high level and kind of a much higher abstraction than the physical act of going to the gym would be. It might only take 2 or 3 steps because the positive side is actually very straightforward to get a positive intention. Now we'll turn to the negative side. And on the negative side, be prepared that typically when you ask the person, so what's the positive intention that this part has? What's it trying to achieve for you? Be prepared for the person saying nothing. It's only destructive. It's useless. It's a horrible part. I hate it. I don't like it. Now, the reason you should be prepared for this is because precisely because they're rejecting this part is the reason that it still exists. So their old rule of thumb is what you resist will persist. What you accept, you gain power over, you get to utilize. So you need to explain to them the difference between behavior and intention. And whilst they don't have to accept the behavior, the sabotaging, this lack of willpower, the sense of not having any energy to go to the gym, the intention behind it is going to be something positive, is trying to do something for them, maybe protect them, maybe something like that. Doesn't really matter. Don't necessarily give them any ideas yet because you want them to spontaneously come up with what's going on. Now, typically, they might start off with something negative like, oh, it just wants to mess up my life. Okay? Don't accept that because that's a negative intention, not a positive one. Now, you can either go behind the negative intention or you can just ignore the negative intention and ask them, what is it trying to do? What's the purpose of it? And it might say something like, well, it wants to prevent me from going to the gym. Now, that's kind of a neutral intention. It may be good, it may be bad, but that's at least going in a direction. So you might say, excellent. So it's trying to prevent you to go to the gym. Why might it do that? What's it trying to achieve by preventing you to go from the gym? Oh, well, it's trying to prevent me. It doesn't want me to get embarrassed, you know, because I'm out of shape and other people will look at me. Okay, so it's trying to stop you getting embarrassed in the gym when other people look at you, right? Sure. So what would be the purpose to, why would we try to prevent you from getting embarrassed? What's it trying to do for you by preventing you from getting embarrassed? And it might go something like, oh, it's so that I can feel good about myself. Oh, so you can feel good about yourself. So when you're feeling good about yourself, what does that do for you? Oh, I get to enjoy my life then. Now, what you're looking for is a high-level normalization again, and typically, you're going to keep going until they come up with exactly the same or pretty much an identical normalization to the positive side. Notice on the positive side, we went from going to the gym, physical health, well-being, enjoying life. Now we've got the negative side, which went from preventing going to the gym, preventing you from getting laughed at or embarrassed, to feel worthwhile, and ultimately to enjoy life. Now, this point, you really get to do the magic. This is the point where the magic happens. You're now basically going to draw their attention to the fact that both parts actually want the same thing. They both want to have enjoyment. Now, once the person realizes this, something magical tends to happen. They begin to start laughing. It's like it's a magical sort of moment when the penny drops and they realize that they've been fighting themselves, but really they want to go in the same direction. So you've basically begun the integration process already. Now, something that you want to do is you want to make sure that the person, first of all, intellectually understands that both parts want the same thing. It helps, of course, if they do say the same thing, but even if they come something with something similar, you want to keep going. You may want to go back to the other side and chunk it up so it's something very, very close. It's very virtually identical, so that they intellectually grasp this idea that both sides actually want the same thing. And it would be better if they work together in order to achieve that outcome rather than fighting each other for dominance. The next thing that you do is to create a little bit of interdependence. How do we do this? Well, we know that both parts want ultimately for the person to enjoy their life more. Now, you create interdependence by actually beginning to look at resources or qualities that each part has that the other part is missing that could help them achieve what they want. With the positive side, it'll be easy. The qualities would be things like, in our example, might be something like, well, it's positive, it's energizing, it's knows what it wants, is, you know, it's goal oriented, etc. Switching over to the negative side, though, they might again start saying, what if you ask them what positive qualities does this have or resources does this have that the other side could use? They might start saying nothing. And again, you have to prod them. And you have to prod them sometimes and say, you mean absolutely nothing? You mean if the other part was as persistent at going to the gym as this part is about preventing you going to the gym, you mean that wouldn't be useful to you? And suddenly they'll start getting like a wry grin and go, well, okay, persistence would be good too. So now you start having the door opening up to be able to have each side appreciate the other and have a resource. The key thing is each part has to identify in the other part a resource that will help it do its own task if they pull together. So now you have, say, on the one side, the positive side, the left-hand side, the part that wants to go to the gym, you have something like it's motivated, it's got a sense of a goal, it feels good, and, you know, it's healthy. Then we turn on to the negative side, and we just find out they have something like it's got persistence, it's self-activated, it never forgets when to do it, it always remembers when it's time to do its thing. It overrides other things because it's more important than them. Now you can say, at this point, you can start integrating the two sides. Your basic point of integration is very simple. You want to get the hands to start moving together. This is, again, a hypnotic thing. Now, often you might find that the hands, as they start talking about the two abilities that each other can use, the resources that each other can use, you might find the hands starting to move together spontaneously. If they don't, you can start suggesting it. You can start pointing their attention out with hypnotic language to say something like, now, as both these parts are pulling together now or wanting the same thing, notice how your hands have a tendency to want to come together. And you pause a little bit. And typically you'll see a little jerking motion of the hands, at which point you can reemphasize it and go, that's right. Notice how those hands want to come together because those parts want to start pulling together, coming together to help you achieve your ultimate goal of enjoyment or enjoying your life. An extra touch of elegance as these hands start coming together is you begin the process of interweaving the parts or the resource of each part, but you start mixing the frames. So you might say, you know, in this part, as you touch maybe one hand or point to one hand, having the persistence to make sure you keep going to the gym. Notice what you've just done now. You've taken the quality from the negative part, and you've used it to enhance the quality of the positive part. And you can do the reverse. And this part maybe pointing to the other hand, and this hand making sure to make that you feel good every step of the way. So now the part that's actually making them feel bad or without energy is now actually being made responsible to feel good, as the positive part was having beforehand. And you can go looping backwards and forwards, mixing and interweaving the negative and positive sides' resources, so it becomes kind of a hazy jumble with just a whole bunch of resources and all aimed at one goal. And what that does is it begins the process of integrating the parts more and more. It confuses the boundaries between the two parts to allow them to integrate. Meanwhile, of course, the hands are getting closer and closer together as you continue with your hypnotic language to encourage this. Now, let's take a little pause here and ask the question, what happens if the hands don't move? You've suggested that they may want to come together, you've paused, you allowed it to happen, and the hands stand stock still. Well, at this point, you begin with non-intrusive methods to suggest that the hands come together a bit more. Typically, I'll have set this up at the beginning by talking about parts, you know, and I'll have my own hands out in front of me, and I'll constantly, the sound you're hearing is my hands clapping together. So when I talk about, you know, this part and that part, what you really want is to get on with going to the gym. So you have this part, that part. So I'm already beginning to set up non-verbally what's going to happen without even telling them. Then, maybe 20 minutes later, once I've set it all up, I've done all the reframes, I've done all the harmonization and getting resources, when I say to them, have you noticed the tendency where the hands want to come together? Pause. I'll let the whole jerking motion begin. If it doesn't, I'll clap my hands together once again. And again, it suggests something. And again, if nothing starts happening, I'll put my hands underneath. I'll cup both of the hands, and I'll begin to lightly tap their hands from the outside. In other words, my one hand is under the left hand, the other hand's under the right hand, and simultaneously I'll tap the outside of the wrists or the arms, which basically suggests that they should be moving inwards. Now, sometimes when you do this, what you'll notice is you'll feel a tension in the arms, like a rigidity. So what can happen is sometimes the hands become so cataleptic, they can't break the spell and get into motion. And what will happen is, as soon as you begin motion, it'll continue pretty quickly on its own. At that point, rather than just tapping their hands, I might actually move the first fraction of an inch for them. So I might just press them closer together by half a centimeter on each side, which begins the process of movement. And then I'll just carry on by tapping it and suggesting that these hands will continue the process on their own, and then I'll let go so the hands carry on moving by themselves. So you have kind of a way of escalating motion and turning the catalepsy into automatic motion. An important point, as you're doing all this, so the hands are coming together, you are using hypnotic language to talk about things coming together, you are interweaving the resources from both sides to begin to blend the boundaries of the two conditions, and you're always referring back to the overarching principle, the enjoyment in life, which is the highest positive intention that both parts share. At the same time, as the hands come very close together, you can also begin to suggest that the images, the pictures, begin to blend, begin to merge, and develop a third, a new image. So by the time the hands come together, so one hand is touching the other one, one hand's cupped on the other one, that those images have collapsed into each other. That's the visual squash. So people will do this differently. Sometimes the hands come together palm to palm, like they're praying, literally squashing the image together. Sometimes one hand will come on top of the other so that one hand ends up holding the other hand like a tray. It doesn't really matter which way it happens, as long as those hands come together and are touching, and importantly, those images blend and become one. At that point, just tell them to close their eyes, hold on to the hands which are now together, and tell them to integrate the new part so that new vision has developed. They have a third picture. You now do the same thing. You tap underneath the hands. It's a suggestion that the hands move up towards the chest, and that's going to bring the image into the chest inside of them. So that then the image comes inside them, you know, integrating the new image, the new part, into the whole personality. So now it's just part of the person rather than being one part. So before they started the process, they were really in three parts. You have the normal person, the part wanting to go to the gym, and the part that didn't. At the end of the process, you just have one person. Everything's come together. And you do it step by step. First, the two sides that are in conflict get integrated together. Second step is to bring those two inside the person. And much like in the previous one, where you had the inner child, the younger version, little Tom, growing up inside the person, you just bring the image inside and let that spread through the neurology, spread throughout that person, and become part of the totality, part of the whole individual. At that point, you go back to your customary testing and future pacing. You just test by asking them about going to the gym and how they feel about it now. You future pace it by, you know, finding different situations where they go to the gym, including negative situations, including situations where they want to go but can't. They maybe can't go for two or three times in a row for work reasons, so they're losing momentum. Can they recover from it? And the opposite, where they come home, they're tired, and they don't want to do it. And notice how the part of them begins to suddenly say, well, I'll do it anyway, I'll just go for 5 minutes and at least I've gone and made a point of going. At that point again, your job is done. The visual squash is a wonderful technique. It works incredibly well. But again, the magic isn't in just some crazy stunt where you get some pictures to move together. It's in the subtleties. It's in the way you set up the intentions, the way you allow the intentions to blend first, the way you use your language to set it all up, so that the thing that they're aware of, which is just the images coming together, becomes a metaphor that represents the actual work that's going on, collapsing of the boundaries between the two different parts and the integration of that into the greater personality. So, now we've come to the end of the seven modality techniques. There is another set of techniques that I want to run you through, which don't really fit into any category. They're not really seven modalities. They're not really anchoring. They have elements of both. I like to call these the more hypnotic techniques because they're based really in hypnotherapeutic processes. And for those of you who are hypnotherapists, you're probably already using something very similar to these techniques, or at the very least, we'll see how straightforward and how easily they just plug into a regular hypnotic session. The first of these, again, is very powerful. It's called the six-step reframe. This is a pattern for doing basically secret therapy, for creating generative changes. The way this works is that you basically give the unconscious mind responsibility for doing all the change. And it's a bit like the visual squash, where the part that used to run the problem behavior ends up running all the solutions. The key distinction between this and something like the visual squash would be that in the visual squash, you have two clearly identifiable parts that are in conflict with each other. In the six-step reframe, there's no really identifiable part. It's just the negative part floating around doing stuff, for example, a smoking behavior. If they've not really tried to stop, if there's just this thing that just keeps driving them towards smoking, you may just want to go straight towards the part that drives the smoking behavior and get that part to switch the way it does things. Again, the six-step reframe is going to draw a distinction between intention and behavior. You're going to hold on to the intention, the secondary gain, the thing is trying to achieve, but you're going to switch behaviors so that you find better behaviors to achieve that intention, which include behaviors that the person is going to be happy about rather than the behaviors that make the person miserable. You can do the six-step reframe totally conversationally, in other words, without any over-hypnotic things, although of course you will need the ABS formula, or you can just do it in a regular trance session with either finger signals or regular responses. The way you do this is very simple. You start off by identifying the problem. It's basically an unwanted behavior or an unwanted feeling. The next thing to do is to create a connection to the unconscious mind. In terms of ABS, we're now straight to the S part of the formula, stimulate the unconscious response. The way to do this non-hypnotically, or rather covert hypnotically, is to just tell the person to check inside themselves and find out if their unconscious mind is willing to communicate with the conscious mind with a simple signal, and just notice what happens. Now, you ask them to basically pay attention to any signal. It could be something like an eyelid flutter. Maybe they've got a twitch somewhere. Maybe they get a feeling in the pit of their stomach. Maybe they get an itch in their leg. It doesn't matter what it is drawn to their attention, but get them to scan their body, get them to scan inside, notice internally what's going on, and if something draws their attention, to tell you what it is. Now, sometimes you need to coach people a little bit to figure out what they're paying attention to, because they'll just disregard signals like itching or bouncing legs or eyelid fluttering, because they're expecting some kind of grand, you know, unconscious revelation, and don't realize that a simple signal like this might also work. Once you get a simple signal, a clean way of doing this, the traditional six-step reframe way of doing this, is to go and ask the unconscious mind, go ahead and intensify that response in order to give me a yes signal. So let's imagine that the response is an eyelid flutter. And then you go, unconscious mind, please go ahead and intensify the response to be able to signify a yes. And then maybe the eye fluttering gets more intense. And you ask them to diminish the response in order to get a no. And then the eye fluttering might come to a stop, or maybe just reduces a little bit. So now you have yes signals and no signals. You just created a basic yes-no symbol. Remember, it could be anything. It could be a feeling, a sensation like hot or cold, a sensation like an itching leg, the itch appearing and disappearing according to the answer. It could be a movement. It could be a whole bunch of things. For those of you who are familiar with the hypnotic pendulum or Chevreul's pendulum, it's very simple to use a pendulum to create yes-no answers. You just get the pendulum to swing one way for yes, swing another way for no, and there you have it. You have your yes-no answers. It's a very simple way of creating unconscious communication. But really, anything goes at this point. The next step. So you've identified the unwanted behavior. You've established communication, yes-no signals with the unconscious mind. In a regular hypnotherapeutic session, you may just want to use finger signals. That's another way of doing this. Now, you go inside, or you get the person to go inside, and get them to generate alternative responses. The first thing you do to do this is you basically get the unconscious mind to ask the unconscious mind to communicate what is the intention behind the behavior. So the behavior at this point, let's say it's smoking, is going to be driven by positive intention. Let's say at this point, the positive intention is so the person can feel cool or adult in their responses. So that's why they turn to it when they are after they have sex or after they've had a stressful day or adult friends, because smoking makes them feel more mature, and those are times that they can do with feeling more mature. So you get them to separate the intention from the behavior and identify what the behavior is. Get the unconscious mind to signal what that intention is. And the unconscious mind will do it in all kinds of ways. Sometimes it's an image, sometimes it's a gut instinct or a feeling people get, and they go, well, I think it's kind of like this. If they come out and say, well, I think it's kind of like this, then just check it with them and say, well, just go ahead and silence, ask your unconscious mind, is this the intention? If the signal intensifies, it's a yes. If the signal diminishes, it's a no. It's just a simple way of checking that the unconscious mind is playing ball. The skill, of course, comes is when you ask the unconscious mind, are you willing to communicate with me the positive intention that drives this behavior? What happens if the unconscious mind says no? Well, at this point, you put your negotiation hat on and you negotiate. You basically start reminding the unconscious mind that you're doing it for their own best interest, that this is a way of getting them to get more of what they want rather than less of what they want, get more harmony, in other words, find ways of achieving their intention in a better way, etc. Ultimately, you get the unconscious mind, and to be honest with you, most of the time the unconscious mind will signal to the person what the positive intention is. Much like in the visual squash, you just ask them, what is the positive intention? And you just chunk up until you have a nice high level positive intention. Now comes the getting alternative behavior section. You can remind the unconscious mind that it's got boundless creativity, and it has. After all, you know, you dream every night and you don't have to plan your dreams, it just happens. You've solved problems without thinking about them. In fact, sometimes the best way to solve a problem is to stop thinking about it, to give your unconscious mind a chance to work on the thing. So the unconscious mind has access to all these resources, feelings, creativity, past memories, wisdom, things people have said in passing that you might not remember consciously, etc. And you're going to get the unconscious mind to get in touch with that creative part of itself, that creative element or ability that it has. And you're going to ask it to begin an unconscious search through the creative processes to find at least 3, but as many as 5 or maybe 10 behaviors that satisfy the same intention at least as well as the old behavior. Let's say it's smoking. So let's say the positive intention is that the person feels more mature, the negative behavior is smoking. Get the unconscious mind to search through its creative processes to find at least 3 behaviors, but as many as 5 or maybe even 10 behaviors that would allow the person to feel as mature as they do when they're smoking, if not more so. And in these other different situations as well. So it's something that's applicable in these different situations. Then you let the unconscious mind go off and do a little bit of a TDS, a little transcerebrational search, let it kind of expand and think about this, that, and the other. And you're really asking it to give you a yes signal when it has found at least 5 alternatives. So you wait for a while, and when you get your signal, the yes signal, that they've got 5 alternatives, you don't have to know what those alternatives are, by the way. You just have to get 5 alternatives. Let the unconscious mind say, I have 5 things that will work at least as well as the problem, the smoking behavior, and I'm not going to tell you what those are. Or I might tell you what those are. It's probably even better if they don't tell you what those are, because then you can't interfere. Now comes the ecology check. You have 5 behaviors which are designed to work at least as well as the problem behavior, in other words, the smoking. You now want to get the unconscious mind to go into the future and rehearse each of those 5 or more behaviors in context to make sure that there's no unwanted side effects, that it works at least as well as the original problem did, the original smoking. So it'll go into the future after they made love to someone and they'll see, does it fit here? Does it work? Does the person feel more mature? They'll fit into a social context with people drinking. And again, does it fit here? Does it make the person feel more mature? The person gets stressful news. Again, does the person get into a more resourceful, more mature state as a result of the alternative behaviors? And the unconscious mind does all of that automatically. All that the person is going to get is a yes or a no signal after each behavior has been tested, tell you this one works, this one doesn't work. You are looking to get at least three behaviors that work at both levels. In other words, they've generated it and it works when it's future paced, when it's tested for ecology. So those five, you might have two that don't work so well, they can be dropped. You want to have at least three processes, but ideally, if you run out of things, you just send them right back into the creativity loop and get them to come up with even more behaviors, and then you do an ecology check on those behaviors until you have a list of between three and five behaviors that will work at least as well. Now you create a commitment. Just like we do on a conscious level, the unconscious mind works quite strongly at the level of consistency and commitment. In other words, if it says it'll do something, it is very likely that it will. Some pretty extreme circumstances have to exist for it to not do what it's promised to do. Okay? So the way you're going to make use of this is you're going to get the unconscious mind to take responsibility for implementing those 3, 5, 10, however many alternatives there are, those 3 or 5 alternative behaviors instead of smoking. In other words, instead of the problem behavior. So you just ask, is your unconscious mind willing to take responsibility for implementing these alternative behaviors instead of smoking? And you wait for a yes signal. If you get a yes signal, great. If you get a no signal, you go right back to negotiation. You really shouldn't be getting a no signal if you've done your initial separating intention from behavior and your ecology check properly. You shouldn't get a no signal because it makes sense for the unconscious mind to choose more ways of getting what it wants. If you do get a no signal, you may want to go back and find better behaviors, and eventually you will get to the point where they'll say, yes, I am willing, or at least the unconscious mind says, yes, I'm willing to take responsibility to try each of these behaviors over, let's say, the next 3 months to make sure to test it to see how well it works instead of the old problem. And then the idea is, you can put in a general generative language to say something like that if it doesn't like the behavior, you can adjust them, you can change them, you can try another behavior out until it finds the right combination of behaviors that will work at least as well as smoking used to, but doesn't involve smoking. In other words, they are free from that habit, but have all the benefits of the new behaviors. Once you get the commitment to that, that's the future pace element, just reorient the person and integrate them. In other words, you're ending the trance experience, you're getting the person to come back and just get on with their life, looking forward to discovering what behaviors spontaneously emerge. Of course, spontaneously is just a code word for letting the unconscious mind do what it does. So that's the 6-step reframe. It's a tremendous technique. It works equally well inside a formal trance as well as inside a covert trance. And the whole process of going inside and checking for an unconscious signal and coming back out, that basically creates a little bit of a fractionation process, which little mini trances, which take people deeper and deeper into hypnosis each time. Again, you're looking for a hypnotic context to exist in order for this situation to go, or for this technique to work. If the person is being very analytical, very critical, and thinking about it too much on a logical level, this technique, like most other NLP techniques, will not work, because you need to bypass the critical factor. That is one of the key pieces, one of the key stages that you have to move through. The next technique is a lot of fun. It's called the new behavior generator. In some respects, the new behavior generator is similar to the circle of excellence, only this time, rather than practicing an emotion, you're practicing a behavior. So the beauty of this approach is basically it helps you to do a lot of around accelerated learning, particularly of learning skills. Step one of the new behavior generator is to identify a model. And a model is going to be basically someone who is great at doing whatever task. It helps if it's a real person, and it really helps if you have seen the person in action. So let's say that you're talking about golf, having seen the person either at a live event or watching videos of them playing golf, so that you are aware of the different nuances of the way they hold themselves, the way they move, etc. Those things will be crucial. At a pinch, you can always use a literary character, an invented character that embodies the new behaviors. But really, unless you know what behaviors that you're trying to install, well, the imagination can only take you so far. I mean, as an example, If you've never touched a piano, you've never seen someone play a piano, you don't even know what sound the different keys make, it's going to be very difficult for you to rehearse or mentally create an imaginary experience of playing the piano because you don't even know what it is. You don't know how it works. You don't know about the rhythms and the movements and the sounds that get associated. You don't know how far apart the keys are. You haven't even seen a piano in your life. So you want to identify a model, and you want to make sure that that model is not only really skillful at what they do, but something that the other person, the person who's going through the new behavior generator, has witnessed that model. The next step is to dissociate from the model. You're going to essentially use the cinema technique or something similar to create a mental movie where you just watch the model doing what they do best. You're going to watch them playing golf, playing tennis, talking to people, writing an essay, inventing something. Whatever the model is about, whatever the behavior is about, you want to basically run a mental movie where you watch that person do their thing. You want to do it more like the new behavior generator. You can get rid of the movie screen and just get that person to be out there in front of them and kind of just imagine a person in front of them doing it. It really doesn't matter. The point is, you're watching the model do what they do best and getting it right. If you get a sense that this is not the right model, that they're not good enough, or that something's missing, or maybe, you know, there's something about that model you find creepy or weird, or they're making certain sacrifices you're not willing to make. For example, a certain sports star that punishing their body too much so that their body isn't healthy anymore. You may want to choose a different model until you have the right model. That's just an ecology check that you want to make sure at the beginning. So once you have the model, you're happy with that model, you've watched them do their skill and they feel good about seeing that skill, there's no reservations, they don't need to change models. The next thing to do is to begin an association. In other words, you're going to start morphing into the model. As you watch the film again, as you watch that model playing golf again, say, you're going to begin to change the physical features of that model to have the physical features of the client. So the face will change. Let's say the model has a beard and your client doesn't. So as they're playing golf, you can notice that the beard starts disappearing, the nose elongating, the jaw dropping. You basically start describing the differences so that by the end of the golf match, the person looks like your client. The same behavior. Your client's face, your client's hands, your client's clothes. Once you have transformed the model so you know what it looks like to what the model looks like, what it sounds like, but the behavior is now being performed by a little version, if you like, of the actual client, you want to go back and do another ecology check. Because now that the model has the client's features, the client identifies with it more, and things might start coming up, like blockages, which might not have come up before. So you just check that the client is, first of all, happy with the model, watching himself doing all those behaviors, and he's happy with the consequences of behaving this way. To use, for example, a tennis metaphor, let's say that the sports star that he's emulating has a very energetic and high-paced style, and that the person that you're working with, your client, has, say, problems with his knees. And he didn't realize until he watched himself, you know, the model morphing into himself and jumping around the place, he didn't realize that possibly this could be quite damaging to his kneecaps. He needs to have a calmer tennis player as a model, because as much as he might admire this style, he can't emulate it without damaging himself. At this point, you just go right back again and you change the model again and you start the whole process again. Other reasons for changing models might be because of impact. In other words, if your spouse were to see you behaving this way, would she freak out? Would she like it? Would he like it? Would there be consequences to your marriage? And it's not just your spouse, it's your parents, it's your friends, it's your siblings, it's your whole social circle. What do people in your environment, how will they respond to it? And are you okay with it? Some people will be, sometimes some people won't, in which case, again, you need to change elements of it. So once you've done the whole ecology check and assuming that the whole thing works out fine, you go to the next step, which is to associate. Now that you've watched the model, you've watched the model change the client, now the client is still disassociated by seeing himself doing the behavior perfectly. It's only a small step for the client to just step into themselves, so into the image, into the screen, and see it through their eyes, feel it through their body, and basically do it all from the first person perspective. So before it was all in the third person perspective, see that person turning into you. And you step inside that, float inside the person, see through your own eyes, feel through your own skin, feel it, hear it, and see it. And again, you run through the whole behavior fully, watching the people around them, noting the things, you know, the grip and what it feels like in their hand, the ball flying, and whatever the behavior happens to be. If you need to add a soundtrack to make it more compelling, just like in the Circle of Excellence, add another soundtrack. That's all good. And get them to particularly pay attention to how they're thinking and how they're feeling differently to the way they do normally. So if you have an average golfer who, say, decides to model Tiger Woods, and then he steps into the Tiger Woods' body, feels the grip changing, feels his motion changing, his stance is different, maybe he's a little bit straighter or more hunched up, his thoughts are different, maybe they're clearer, maybe they're more strategic, whatever it happens to be, just notice those distinctions. And then just rehearse that a few times, and then, by a few times, of course, I mean your conditioning cycles are 5 or 6 times, so that it becomes natural. So you're going to start future pacing it so that the person starts going into real situations. The next golf match they're going to be going into. The next tournament they'll be going into. The next lesson they'll be going into. So they're going into real life situations with the natural cues that would be normally in their environment. And notice how those cues now trigger the good behavior. And now you're going to basically condition that future pace. So, gone through a process of watching the model. You've morphed the model's features so they become like the client. You've done another ecology check to check that the client's okay with the consequences of that. Then the client steps into the image of themselves performing it perfectly, and they rehearse that a few times. You now do a future pace. You put the client into the real situation behaving that way, and then you condition it. You do it 3, 4, 5, 6 different situations where they're rehearsing that over and over again, but in different situations, like the next week's championships, in 6 months' time, the championships, etc. This golf club, that golf club, a third golf club. So that they have more experiences. Eventually, you can add some general hypnotic language along the lines of this can continue to grow and excel, etc. Then bring them back, reorient them to the present time and place, and give them a sense of looking forward to what the future will bring. It's a wonderful technique, and it's a great way of assisting accelerated learning.